Welcome to Talking Up Music Education, a podcast from the NAMM Foundation.
Welcome to a very special episode of Talking Up Music Education, recorded live from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio. Host Mary Lurson is joined today by New York Times columnist and turnaround artist David Brooks, President and CEO of Americans for the Arts, Bob Lynch, and President and CEO of the National Association of Music Merchants, Joe Lamond.
Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Mary Lurson, Executive Director of the NAMM Foundation, and we are here in Cleveland for the Arts Speak Policy Forum about the transformative power of the arts. Thank you for joining us for this special edition of Talking Up Music Education, a NAMM Foundation podcast celebrating the benefits and joys of music learning. On today's episode, we are recording at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio, the city where the Republican National Convention is taking place. Joining me today is NAMM President and CEO Joe Lamond, and a great friend of NAMM, fellow musician and President and CEO of Americans for the Arts, Bob Lynch, and David Brooks, New York Times columnist, author, and turnaround artists for the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
Thank you.
Hi.
All right. So first, I'd love each of you to share with us what brings you to Cleveland besides the Republican National Convention. Basically, what are you doing here at the Republican National Convention? I'd appreciate hearing about the activities or events that you're participating in. Who'd like to start?
You're just looking at me, so I shall begin. NAMM represents the craftsmen, the builders who make all these great music and sound products that bring music to the world. And it's just fitting that we're here in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where so many of those products have turned into the soundtrack of our lives. But we're here because what we truly believe in is the value of music and arts education for all children. And to have that become a reality, we really have to be in the conversation about policy and national arts policy. And so we'll be here this week and we'll be in Philly next week at the DNC. But this is very important to us. These are the people who have the ability and our hope is that they will listen to us and then use their power to ensure that every child has an equal access to a great education in this country, one that includes music and the arts.
So we're here in our proper role as advocates and to influence our vision for the world.
Make sure our voice is heard.
That's right. Bob Lynch.
So Americans for the Arts is the national organization for advancing all of the arts in the lives of all of the people. Founded in 1960, way back then, we were the organization that pushed for the creation of the National Endowment for the Arts, for example. We also are the Americans for the Arts Action Fund, a political organization with 300,000 citizen advocate members to try to talk to decision makers, federal, state, local, and get pro-arts and pro-arts education policies passed at all those levels. Well, the reason I'm here in Cleveland is leaders from all those levels are here. People who are working on the presidential campaign, mayors, city council members, governors, lieutenant governors, and every one of them contributes to the decisions that will put pro-arts policies in place. And so I'm really excited to be working on ArtSpeak with our partner, NAMM, and also our third partner together, the United States Conference of Mayors. And together, we hope to make some really positive issue statements about the arts and arts education, get some good dialogue going, make some new friends, and get some things done for America through the arts.
Can you tell us a little bit about the event that happens this afternoon? Who's attending? Who's moderating?
Sure. The event this afternoon is a policy discussion, ArtSpeak, that is happening right here at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's about 2 hours long with a reception afterwards, and we'll have 250 to 300 policy leaders, people who are here at the Republican National Convention as delegates, congresspeople, some folks from the state level, lieutenant governor, so on. And the discussion, moderated by Mike Huckabee, is going to go through a series of dialogues about what's happening with the arts and why the arts are important in a variety of places, in education, in the military, in community, and in the lives of people all across America, particularly at this particularly tough time for America with so many tragedies happening. How can the arts help, and how can arts policy help And that's what we're hoping the dialogue will produce, more ideas that people will take back to their homes or to their jobs as elected officials all across the country.
And then it all happens again next week at the DNC in Philadelphia.
Absolutely. We all together go and work again with all the leaders at the Democratic Convention. And the thing that's also great in both cases is we have artists with us. Ben Folds here, for example, in Cleveland. And then next week, Ben Folds joins us again, along with Ben Vereen. So this is the fourth time, I think, that NAM and Americans for the Arts have worked together on this. And we are looking forward to really good results and new friends.
And it's very important that we're here. So David, why are you here?
I don't know why I'm here. I have been asking myself that for the past week. I'm just trying to survive and get out of here. So what I do is I have a job where I write a column for the New York Times, but I also work for National Public Radio and Public Broadcasting, covering the convention. So I sit in a booth in a studio on the arena executive level for about 5 hours a night, listening to every damn speech. And so they wash over me. And my connection to the arts is one of a lifeline. On the way home, the New York Times, because we're such a fancy organization, we're staying at an Econo Lodge somewhere, I think in Indiana. And so I have a long drive every night in the middle of the night, and a long walk from the parking garage to the arena. And so I have my headphones with me at all times, and I spend a lot of time on Pandora, simply trying to get some spiritual sustenance that will sustain me through hours and hours of political speeches.
So you are here in your official capacity?
Yes, only my official capacity. In my spiritual capacity, I'm completely absent.
Okay. But I have to say that as someone who's been following the PBS coverage, it's kind of wonderful to watch it gavel to gavel the way you're presenting it. So let's pull back the lens a bit. You know, I'd welcome if each of you would share briefly, because I know it's probably a deep and precious story for each of you, but how the arts really impacted your life. And, you know, I'm sitting here with the drummer, our CEO, Joe Lamont, and Bob Lynch, your guitarist and instrument collector, pianist, famous jam musicians around the country. And David, we know that you're a celebrated author and, you know, very much an artistic and creative life. What got you hooked on a creative life? And why is this something that we are all so eager to have for every child in our lives and in our country, in our world?
Well, David? I read a book when I was seven called Paddington the Bear and decided at that moment I wanted to become a writer. And in all the days since then, I probably have not been 100 days where I haven't written something. And my joke is that in high school, it's true, I wanted to date a woman named Bernice, and she didn't want to date me. She dated some other guy. And I remember thinking, what is she thinking? I write way better than that guy.
And so, was that guy a guitarist, maybe?
He probably was.
Or a drummer. It's
the essential tragedy of my life. But writers, we work alone in a room. Musicians get to work with each other late at night while drinking. It's a much better job. But I will say one thing, which the story that comes to mind as we talked, is I work in profession, politics, and journalism, which is not always emotionally and spiritually rich. And I live in Washington, D.C., which is the most emotionally avoidant city on the face of the earth. And I had an occasion, I was asked by the Public Theater in New York to come and appear on a panel. And in Washington, I've appeared on a million panels. But in this one, Anne Hathaway was there, a bunch of musicians, a clown, a professional clown named Bill Irwin was there. And we got backstage, and we had a big group hug. Because we were going to support each other through this panel. I remember thinking, we don't do this at the Brookings Institution. We don't have group hugs before our panels. And then Anne got up there and sang before the panel. And there were tissues on stage in case we started crying. And then afterwards, we had another group hug. And it was just a more emotional experience. And that was about 5-7 years ago. And I thought, this is what I've been missing. And so since literally, that was a sort of a pivotal moment when I realized what I'd been missing in my life. And now I spend probably 3 or 4 days in New York around artists and around musicians, and have shifted away from the emotionally thin world that I had been formerly living in to hopefully in a more richer one.
And a world we want for every person, really.
Yeah.
Right?
But sometimes in the fastness of life, you have to take a step outside the distraction of the day to get something where you can count on being emotionally touched at one point in the day.
We promise a hug when we're done. Okay. Or at least I want one for sure. That's really great. Bob, I know there's a great story there on your journey as a musician and advocate 40 years.
Absolutely. Well, there's a few, and it's interesting because I went to Catholic grammar school and Catholic high school, 8 years of Sisters of St. Joseph and 4 years of Jesuits. And one of the things that was interesting is that there was very little art, formal art, in my curriculum for those 8 years. And in high school, we did read the Aeneid in Latin in high school. That was an artistic pursuit. But in the eighth grade, I had a nun who had to teach everything, Sister Mary Andrina. And one of the things she was skilled at was finding an interest in every single student, different interest. And in me, she found poetry and writing. And so I sort of became the person in the class that you went to for writing. Could have helped David back in those early days. But what happened then is that ended up being a pathway for me, ultimately professionally. I was a poetry major in college. But the other thing was that in the eighth grade, that summer, my father was in the Army Reserves. We went down to a 2 week reserves maneuvers, in essence, and he brought the family. And my brother and I went down to the swimming pool. I remember it very clearly. We're down at the swimming pool, and at one end of the swimming pool were all of these guys horsing around and pushing each other into the water. And at the other end of the pool were all of the girls and one guy with a guitar. And I thought, the arts, that's the pathway. So when I went off to high school, the thing that was most interesting to me in high school was we formed a rock and roll band, a garage band. And those were the days when you formed the band, then you bought the instrument, then you learned how to play it. And that was the way it worked. But we actually ended up being together, playing together and hanging out. And 50 years later, I just last month was together with the guys and we played some songs. So interestingly for me, the human side of the arts was a motivator for me. But in that pathway, it ended up also being a career. And in the career, I had all of the same kinds of experiences that David described about artists and individuals from the community coming together and being better off, being happier, being healed in some cases, being motivated because of the arts were in their lives. And so I thought that's something that I want to spend my life doing and bringing to everybody else.
And how many guitars do you have?
Well, one of the things is that I don't play all that well, but I make it up by collecting. So I have six acoustics, one electric, and one bass.
That's wonderful. It's a wonderful story, too. I didn't really know all the elements of that story. Well, Joe Lamond, there's quite a tale here. How did it start in a life in music for you?
You know, I can relate to the pool scene with Bob. And but as a young person, I think what all young people strive for is to be accepted and to be part of a herd in some way or another. And I think for me, music was that pack. And, I think people are drawn to different instruments. And again, I don't make any claim that music has an exclusive role in that, but I think all children need to be belonging to something. And for me, it was in a band, and for me, it was the drums. And from a very early age, I just knew that I wanted to play drums. So my hero drummers, of course, Ringo Starr, Danny Seraphin from Chicago, or my dad. I remember when I said I want to play drums, he got Creedence Clearwater Revival's album, Cosmos Factory, and handed it to me and said, here, learn to play like this. And so that was kind of like my instruction. Okay, like study, you know, really carefully how Creedence, you know, and all those great songs off of that album. So then, you know, again, it was a neighborhood band. You know, older brother played bass, guy across the street played guitar, guy up the road played keyboards, and there was many bands like ours. We played in junior high school, I think my first gig when I was about 10 or 12 years old. But just, you know, playing music for other people, being a part of those moments in the garage, and just the fun, the camaraderie that came out of that, you know, it set me on a path. And, you know, did I know at age 12 that someday I'd be involved in music as a career and lucky enough to be involved in something that has, you know, deep meaning like supporting music education? No. At that point, I just wanted to be the guy at the other end of the pool with the girls. And but it really again, I think it fulfilled kind of an essential element of every young person, which is they need to belong. And I think part of the challenges we're seeing today is the absence of that, and a vehicle for kids to belong. And without that, I think people get a little aimless. So it gave me good direction, gave me a pack to belong to, a language and a way to act and to belong in a way that was very, very meaningful to me. You know, the trajectory of a life, you know, how do you know that if that hadn't occurred, what would be different? But you don't get to run a parallel experiment. But for me, getting the first drum set when I was about 10 years old changed everything.
And I think the, you know, asking you this question is really underscoring why we're advocates. You know, it grows from our own stories, but also something that we've turned into a passion to want to create for every child everywhere. I was one of those kids that grew up in the middle of nowhere, literally. And for some magical reason, there was a group of enlightened adults that said, these kids that are in a really impoverished rural environment need to have these opportunities. And they went out and found teachers that made sure we had these very sophisticated opportunities and was the backbone really for an entire life. So, you know, we're the adults now, right? And you know, we need to go out and do this work, and we're very grateful that we get to do this work together.
The New York Times. You've been listening to Talking Up Music Education, a podcast of the NAM Foundation.
So I want to take a little bit of a turn into acknowledging the fact that we do live in complex times, and we are going through some very disturbing civic and social disruption. There's a lot of distrust for our formal organizations like security and our civic organizations. And my question about this is are we bold enough as artists and artist advocates and an artistic community to both, you know, be the expressive element of what's truly happening? And are we also presenting ourselves as the as a solution? Joe used the word that, you know, the sense of belonging, the basic needs that are coming out of our young people. And how could we be bolder? And, you know, here we are at these two national political events being as kind of bold as we can in this environment. What other way should we be both inspiring artists to be bold and maybe as a field going out and creating more solutions for folks to come together and maybe inspire them to create their own solutions in their own communities? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm happy to jump in on that one. I think that it's situational. We're bold enough in some places and we're not bold at all in other places. And I think that where there is boldness, there is often not enough support for that boldness. So here's an example. If you look at the arts in America, the nonprofit arts alone, only about 9% of that money comes from government. We're here at an event about the government to try to tell them that, hey, they ought to do more. Because when we see that boldness, we see the real positive effects of it. You take a look at some of the strife that's happened in different cities across the country. And you take a look at a place like Charleston, for example. Charleston has had a long investment in art and the boldness of the arts. And they had a horrific event happen, but they handled it very differently, not just because of the arts, but because of a civility that the arts contributed to. They handled it very differently than what might have happened and what did happen in other places. You take a place like Baltimore after their tragedy and there were riots. And how did the arts handle that? Well, the arts opened up the symphony. They opened up the museums. They opened up everything for free to try to have people have a place to come together and have that group hug that was talked about and learn about one another. I found it striking there in Baltimore that the baseball game also went on, but they didn't allow anybody in. The game played in an empty stadium. So an opposite approach to this. So I think that certainly my job is to advocate for more money for the arts, but I'm a believer too. And I realize that that investment gives us a better town or a better state or a better nation. And that is what I think I'm fighting for. And I see the results, but situationally.
I wasn't aware that happened in Baltimore, mm-hmm. that the symphony orchestra opened up, that there was just a very deliberate action by that community.
Very
deliberate response.
Deliberate action, and also the local arts agency in that community helped facilitate some of that communication about those kinds of activities. We can all participate and contribute, but there has to be something there, arts organizations or some kind of an entity, in order to do that good work.
So we need the adequate funding and support that allows these networks just to exist and to come together.
That's one of the things,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Other thoughts about that? How can we be bolder? Contribute to the solutions.
Well, the thing is, there's a lot of symptoms of these are long-term societal issues we're dealing with. And I think, getting back to some of the root causes where I think, arts and their role within the community, many of us are part of this President's Committee on Arts and Humanities. And the Turnaround Arts Program is just, to me, such a perfect visual representation of the power of the arts in those schools. And these are some of the lowest performing schools in the country. And we've seen them improve on all levels that are measured in academics today, from scores and attendance and graduation rates going on to college, the inclusion of the arts. But more importantly, we brought these schools together at the White House in May, total different walks of life. I mean, the event that we had at the Turnaround Arts with Lame Deer School in Montana. I mean, I'll never get that visual out of my mind of that school performing for the First Lady in the East Room. And towards the end of that performance, the president walked in and all the kids came running up together from these different schools and were just so moved. But there was one particular kid from Lame Deer, and this is very much an impoverished, I think it's Native American school. And talking to the teachers before, really learning about the challenges that these kids have. That school and that group of performers, and this one boy in particular, will never be the same. He was changed forever. And it was because of his involvement in the arts. And again, this is long-term. The outcome of that day or the outcome of that program might not be really seen societally for 10, 15 years. But that's the role of the arts. I think it's fundamental for a nation like ours to put those root. If we want these results long-term, we have to make the investments. You have to plant if you want to harvest much later on. I think, unfortunately, I'm afraid we're harvesting some things that have been planted over the years that aren't healthy. People are not feeling connected or rooted to their communities or having empathy for those who aren't like them, particularly music and arts, actually bring all of those communities together in a more appreciative way. I mean, there's nothing better to me than music to actually link culture and to break down barriers. And again, that starts at a very young age. The boldness comes from, this Rock Hall is full of people who commented on the changes. I mean, the lyrics of a Dylan or Johnny Cash, even recognizing the world as it is. But then there's much more fundamental than that. It's as a music teacher in a school, one at a time, helping plant a seed for someone that may grow up someday to be a great contributor to society, maybe in a policy way, maybe president of the United States. But it starts a long time ago.
So in our advocacy efforts at the NAMM Foundation, we have a biphrase called relentlessly positive. I think you've added another one, which is to be relentlessly bold. We have to build for the long term. David, you've been thinking about this as our speakers have been.
Yeah, well, I think you have to delineate certain levels. So there's a certain level of policy activity that I don't think the artists are particularly useful in contributing to, and that's whether we should intervene in Syria or what kind of development assistance we can do. Obviously, if an artist, as non-artists, develops some expertise, as say Bono has, then they can offer some real advice. But to be honest, sometimes I think artists don't take the time to develop the expertise. They come in with an emotion, which is sometimes combined with publicity, and can do harm if you don't actually take the time to know what you're talking about. But then there's a deeper level. One of my favorite couplets is from Samuel Johnson: of all the things that human hearts endure, how few are those that kings can cause and cure. And what he means by that is most of what really matters in our lives is subpolitical. And some of that, as Joe was saying, is belonging, is community building. And we live in an extremely divided society. I think the arts can be a lot bolder in getting working class right-wing whites in Northern Alabama together with African Americans in New York City. And that would just be a great social need that we have right now, because we are becoming a fragmenting society. Second, belonging in school. Joe mentioned Turnaround for the Arts, which I'm getting involved in. And I had a school superintendent in California said, what keeps kids in school? It's the ABCs, athletics, band, and cheerleading. And there are a lot of kids who are just not that academic, but they need to stay in school and they need some emotional investment in school. And if they can be inspired by an artist coming to their school and changing their life or providing a model, that's a life-altering thing. And then the third thing the arts can do, I think, is clarify our perception of the world. And I mean that both emotionally, what the arts do is they widen our repertoire of emotions, but also conceptually. We're here in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The human voice that I've listened to more than any other person outside my immediate family is Bruce Springsteen, who is celebrated and a member here. And recently I had a column about a Springsteen song called We Take Care of Our Own. And that phrase, and especially the way he uses it in that song, which came out probably 3 or 4 years ago, is very pregnant to our political discussion. Because on the one hand, it makes you feel good. We take care of our own. But in the verses of that song, he's suggesting when you take care of your own, you often don't take care of people who are not your own. And our political debate is filled with people who want to really take care of the people within their tribal community, Donald Trump, and other people who would think, you know, we have an obligation to people who are not within our tribal community. And that tension between taking care of our own and taking care of others outside our own is a central tension in our politics. And Springsteen's songs really illuminates that tension. So I'd say the arts are foundational in the way they affect the world, but shouldn't always be legislative when it comes to like the Glass-Steagall Act or something like that.
But I sense that you are maybe putting forth a call to action that we should be bolder.
Well, what's the number one problem facing America? I teach college, I always say, what's the number one challenge facing your generation? It's social isolation. There are just a lot of people in society falling through the cracks. I've spent the last 4 months traveling around to some of the poorer areas in the country, and the opiate usage is just amazing. And what can music, what can the arts do is they create community, and they can end social isolation, they can create connection. So how could the arts not have some role to play in that?
Thank you.
Very good.
Sure, and Bob.
Just want to follow up with David on one thing, and that is that Americans for the Arts does an award ceremony every year in the fall, the National Arts Awards, and we honored Lady Gaga last year. And David was in the audience. And then the next day, to my delight, he did part of his column on the word passion and Lady Gaga as a representative of passion, which is a kind of boldness. And I see that in all of the turnaround artists as well that we work with. And I'd love you to just expand a little bit on what you were saying there, what you saw.
She just gave such a remarkable speech at that dinner about her own passion for music. And we all want to lead a life of passion, but it's hard to do it without an example right there in front of you of someone who is completely all in, whose emotions are aroused, and whose reason for being is really to express through the music, and who has... I always say commitments involve a double negative. I can't not do this. And in Lady Gaga, you got that double negative sense. And she was super articulate about how her life has been transformed and really brought to a point by her passion for music.
Well, thank you. This is going to be a great message for folks who really value or are helping us with this work in the field. You know, so much of what Talking at Music Education is connecting a community of advocates for music education. And our hope for our podcast was really to be a source for inspiration to them. So this is really, it's really been inspiring for me. So let's turn a corner and talk a little bit about the fact that we are at the Republican National Convention. So I've got to ask a couple of quick questions. So how do you view a Clinton or Trump presidency in terms of the potential relationships to building with Congress? Do you think there's going to be a big change with either one of them? David.
Okay, I'll go first. Ambivalent feelings about how Secretary Clinton did as Secretary of State, but unambivalent feelings about how she did in the U.S. Senate. I thought she was an outstanding senator. And I would say Republicans and Democrats alike would say that. And she put her own profile second and really served the institution and made a lot of friendships with the Republicans. And I would say one of the strengths of a Clinton presidency would be her ability to work with other politicians and especially members of Congress. That's demonstrated. You don't have to speculate about that. As for Donald Trump, he has spent some time in the Senate recently. I've spoken to a lot of senators who met with him. Their problem is getting him to talk about any subject other than himself. And so that's not always a recipe for a good meeting or a cooperative relationship with Congress.
But, you know, Hillary Clinton was my senator, right? I'm in New York. And I'm astounded how much time I've had to spend sort of telling people what a great senator she was. She was our senator after 9/11. She worked for all of these benefits for the first responders. And so that's interesting. Bob or Joe, you want to go in that direction? How do you think the Congress is going to work?
Sure. Well, actually, one of the things David said earlier about artists sometimes not being legislative in a legislative setting, but we're in a time of legislators not being legislative in a legislative setting. And that's what these, whoever the president is going to be, has to deal with that. People who are reluctant to play nice and work together. I have had the opportunity over the last 20 years to do some work with Hillary Clinton, a number of things over the years. And the Hillary Clinton I have seen is a master of that kind of thing. Very warm, very engaged, incredibly smart. And she is somebody who will work very hard at that. And I just hope that there's a platform, if she's the president, who will play back. Both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton responded to our requests for arts positions. Where do you stand on the arts? What we got with Hillary through some film clips of people asking her these questions was positive and legislative, and with ideas for increases in various areas and investment in arts education like that. We also got positive from Donald Trump, but not necessarily things that were specific or that you could point to as directions that he was going to go. So it's a bit of a mystery on that front, what would happen. But nothing will happen unless this becomes first priority.
You know, NAM represents the business community and 10,000 businesses here in the United States and around the world. So we take a very pragmatic approach. I think we need to. Some of these businesses that belong to NAM go back to the 1840s. So we have seen about every change you can imagine, not only politically, but, you know, just in the world itself. You know, I guess I take some comfort in the founding fathers' general distrust of human nature in general, and by devising a set of government structures that really limit in many ways the power of the U.S. president. He's probably, he or she, ironically, while being the leader of the free world, has more limits in their movement than most other leaders in the world when it comes to actually doing anything. There's such a strong, you know, check and balance, for better or worse, that the founding fathers put in place. So from our pragmatic approach is we have to work with everybody. That's just the way it is. And so there's that level of just, you know, pragmatism at the federal level. Quite frankly, I'm much more excited about working at the state and the local level. I think the hope of this great country is in the mayors of the United States. You know, they respond, they're in the street, they're in the neighborhoods, they're the closest to the people in that sense, in the leadership, I mean, mayors and city councils. You know, if I had to really be, you know, where my optimistic self comes is when I travel around the country and visit with mayors and realize the wonderful things that are happening in cities. We were just in Nashville for the Summer NAMM Show, and the mayor of Nashville, she's just doing some tremendously amazing things with that city, including making sure that every kid in that city from elementary school on has a music and arts education. It can be done at that level. I think things are more difficult at the federal level, but the state and local level, that's where I think things are exciting and very, very optimistic and hopeful.
You know, and I couldn't agree more, Joe. And the example I gave earlier of Charleston, what I didn't mention is that's because of Mayor Joe Riley and his work over all those years that Charleston became such a great destination using culture and the arts.
So we have to accept more chaos on some levels, and where we can have more clarity and engagement, we have to go there, which is just the reality of our state and local communities now, right? Again, part of our coalition effort is to really encourage people to be involved in their local communities, school boards especially, working with school administration is all part of our goals, knowing that we have to be aware of what's happening and impact as best we can on the federal level. We have a new education law that is now going to be implemented in this next year. We're trying to communicate with our advocates about their role in this rollout. And these resources are certainly coming down through Americans for the Arts. It's very active in this communication, as well as the NAMM Foundation. So we encourage our listeners to please be involved in that, because this is our chance now to really involve.
Well, I think Senator Alexander put it perfectly, that the new Every Student Succeeds Act is the largest give back of federal power to the states in probably two generations. And that speaks to the even the more importance of the state and local level of managing in governing and doing the right things as the people of those areas demand.
As we move toward the end of our podcast, I can't resist the chance to ask each of you. In the last couple of weeks, I've been indulging in a few flashbacks of my own to look at some of the political movies that I've enjoyed over the last couple of years. Now with Netflix and streaming and all sorts of other opportunities, I've pulled up a few. And I just am curious to know, what is your favorite political movie from the past that you'd like to maybe share with our audience?
So there's a lot of good ones that are out there. The Candidate with Robert Redford is a great one. But the one I like the most goes way back, maybe because of my Boston roots, and it's The Last Hurrah with Spencer Tracy. And that was loosely the story of James Michael Curley, who, as a great Irish politician, also indicted and imprisoned many times, he was working for change and people, and sometimes bad things got in the way. But all of the things that we talk about related to networking, connections, and just old style politics is in that movie. So I recommend everybody see it, and you'll learn what to do and what not to do.
And the name of that movie is again?
The Last Hurrah.
All right. Just make sure we'll tell everybody about that. David, how about you?
I'll mention three quickly. All the King's Men, which is a great, great novel by Robert Penn Warren, but also quite a good movie, turned into a good movie. And then I'll mention two John Ford movies, which are not traditionally political, but I think are in their own way. One is called My Darling Clementine, which was a Western with Henry Fonda. And all the other Westerns had this myth that there's some lone cowboy went out there and settled the West. But My Darling Clementine is about community building. It's about how Americans would move to a place, put in a church, put in a dentist, put in a theater, and a teacher would come to town, and how they created a community, which is actually how the West was settled, not through some lone individualist. And then I have to mention my favorite movie of all time, which is also a John Ford movie called The Searchers, which is relevant to today's times. John Wayne is a racist. The hero of the movie is a racist in that movie. And it's a scathing portrait of someone who is fighting to defend law and order, basically, and has been propelled into certain attitudes which imprison him. And it's a very sophisticated portrayal of somebody who's serving community in a brutal way, but because of that service is locked out of civility and locked out of domestic life and locked out of the home. And John Wayne's portrayal, for people who don't think he was a great actor, is really an amazing thing. And I think it happens to be my favorite movie because it's so morally complicated.
Mm. Well, that's gone on to my list. I wasn't aware of that movie.
How Searchers is the name.
The Searchers. Yeah.
I think, again, from the business side, very pragmatic. I like the show The West Wing, a show instead of a movie, but the instructive nature of how things get done. It was great. I thought it was very well written. In every episode, you saw how things actually are, how government actually runs, which is quickly find out the minimum you need to know about a subject, make a decision, and move on to the next one, never ever really becoming an expert in any one thing, yet maybe making a policy that could change the lives of 325 million people. It's just like, that's how it's done? Are you kidding me? That's all they did? They talked about it for about just between one commercial and the next, and now all of a sudden we've got a law? So it was just very, in some ways, instructive to me in our action and how we shape our policy sometimes of how we need to approach, Capitol Hill and the administrative branch. But just the idea of, holy smokes, this is how it works. And if it was real, it could be wrong. And I'm basing NAM's complete government policy on a myth, but I think it's actually probably correct that is the level sometimes of dialogue or investigation that goes into something that could actually have changed the entire course of the nation or the world. And I'm just surprised by that. Sometimes we put way more planning into planning the NAM show each January. So
it's totally accurate, by the way, from my understanding of
government. It's frightening yet interesting at the same time.
Well, I have to share that there's several that I've been indulging in, but one really stuck out at a moment in the movie. And I was saying at breakfast today too, that whoever wrote the script to Game Change, there was some really pretty profound artistic foreshadowing that happened at the end of that movie. And it's the story of McCain, Sarah Palin, the vetting of Sarah Palin, the Steve Schmidt's engagement with her preparation. And ultimately, McCain has to give a concession speech. And right at the end, McCain turns back to Sarah, who's been buffeting around wanting to give her own concession speech, which really doesn't take place. And so he turns to her, he's walking out of the room, and yet he stops and he comes back to her and he looks her right in the eye and says, Sarah, you are now a leader in the Republican Party, and you have to be very careful. So because the radical extremists are taking over our party and they could change it forever. And I was sort of at home listening to this movie in the background as I was, you know, bustling around doing various things. And I literally stopped. And it was because it was really a foreshadowing of so many of the issues that we're talking about, dealing with, trying to understand right now. And some scriptwriter, some artist, very thoughtfully was looking into the future and wrote that dialogue, you know, about that moment. So, but there's so many. That's one. And then I did go back and indulged in The War Room, which is the 1992 documentary with the Raging Cajun, James Carville, and George Stephanopoulos and their final months run up to the Clinton election. And it was like there's so many that, but thank you for sharing yours. So the last thought is that in the future made for TV movie, who will play Donald and who will play Hillary? Any artistic projections?
I think Kevin Spacey will play Donald.
And I know Kevin Spacey well. He could probably adapt to that very well.
He has all of the different chameleon-like elements that could go into that. And then Susan Sarandon could play Hillary. Again, a complex personality with who can project warmth and iciness, and but great effectiveness.
My two actors are in the big studio in the sky, but I'm thinking John Candy for Donald Trump, and this will make you no friends in the Clinton White House, but Joan Crawford is my pick for Hillary Clinton.
Oh, that's so interesting. That's
great. I don't think I can top any of those suggestions, but I will state unequivocally, it will be a comedy.
Not a tragedy, not a horror.
It will just be a comedy.
Yeah. Do you think as this convention, we're in the middle of the RNC convention, are we going to have any Clint Eastwood empty chair moments, do you think? Are we waiting? Are we waiting for that? That was replayed too in my, as I was looking at these old clips of former conventions, previous conventions, and I was on the floor again watching that. Are we going to have a moment like that?
I would kind of welcome a moment like that. I think we need something interesting. I remember moments, though, that were spectacular, like any time Ted Kennedy spoke at a convention.
Yeah.
And some things that we've done together over the years, bringing John Legend, for example, to the Democratic Convention in Denver as a panelist on our, for example, the art speak that we're doing today. And then the Democrats saw how great he was and stole him for everything. He started performing all over the convention, which was wonderful.
Yeah. And we had John Rich, who's actually performing here,
yep,
who came forward as such a remarkable story, his own personal story, and also such a firm believer in music education. It was really pretty amazing experience. That.
His life changed by the arts. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Lynyrd Skynyrd is here in some form. We could have the surviving members of Lynyrd Skynyrd maybe with an empty chair singing Freebird.
Why don't you dial that in, David? Make that happen over there.
This has been actually stylistically, I think political conventions are set to be blown up and really recreated as much more creative endeavors instead of just a series of state legislators giving speeches. But this has been stylistically a very conservative convention. And so I'm a little disappointed in that. I expected one thing Trump could do was reality TV.
We needed an empty chair. Joe, any thoughts?
I just think as a gathering of the tribes, I mean, it's just, it's ready for a change. I believe you, David. I think that when people are coming together in any, whether it's a festival like Burning Man or Coachella, I mean, tribes are coming together. There's no doubt that people want to gather with those that are of like mind. But I'm not sure if these models are really fulfilling that need anymore. I think there's something different. And just to make one connection to the music side, I just believe, you know, the best musicians had a highly refined gift for listening. And I find that sorely lacking in on both sides, quite frankly. And so that could be a change of how these conventions are run. It's not just all about sending and sending. It's a little bit about receiving too. And I just think that is you can watch a little bit of that, just all one way communication, but people turn it off pretty quickly. This has to be a conversation. This has to be where groups are actually communicating back and forth. And again, we can just take an eye from even the most famous musicians who are known for their, you know, stellar expertise on their instruments. You know, they showed it rarely, but they spent, you know, guys like Eric Clapton, they spent most of their time listening and listening to the band and playing what was appropriate. And I find that just absolutely lacking in today's discourse.
But not here on this podcast. We've had a wonderful conversation. Any final thoughts from any of you as we wrap this up?
One final thought for me, just in the years that we've done this, you know, three or four times in presidential elections, we're here, but the cast of characters who we're speaking to is constantly changing. There are constantly new congresspeople and new mayors and new elected officials of all kinds, new delegates. So our message has to be repeated again and again. And we have as the arts and arts education and music education, a great message. We are better for community. We know that. We're better for the economy. We know that. We're better for helping military returnees. We know that. And we just need to make those cases and all of that data constantly available to the decision makers. And that's about the best we can do to try to get to where we need to go for America.
Thank you. Any other final thoughts?
I'll say one thing. I just want to thank you guys for being here at the Republican Convention. The arts community is a pretty progressive community. And sometimes one meets artists who have never apparently met a Republican and seems strange to them that they exist without horns and things like that. So I just am appreciative of the people in the arts community are listening to both sides.
And I think we have recognized over time that we have to have our voice in both places, in all places at all times. So.
I mean, that's taking the long view. You know, like I say, NAMM's 116 years old now and has seen so much change. And again, you know, the business community could say sometimes might be at odds at some of the policies or of some of the more progressive, you know, these people are running businesses, they're hiring people, they are actively engaged in commerce. Yet our business is music. And our business is being involved in supporting the, you know, the musical life of this country. So we sometimes find ourselves conflicted. I mean, here we are in the Republican conventions this week, you know, because I mean, I think a lot of our NAMM businesses would love to see a little bit less regulation on whether they hung the bathroom sign 3 feet off the ground or 3.5 feet off the ground, whether they got fined for that or not. Yet next week at the Democratic convention, there'll be so much more cooler people. It's like, you know, how come they get to have more fun than some of this side? I mean, it's just really, we're conflicted as business people within the music world. But again, pragmatic aside, we want policies that allow for a strong education for all kids. And that to me transcends, I don't care what your ideology is. If you can't find the wisdom of that, of preparing the young generation to lead in this free country, if that becomes a problem with your ideology, then I'm not sure if any of us could be of help at that point.
So I want to thank you so much for being part of this. Bob, David, thank you for being with us. Joe Lamont, our CEO. Special thanks to Claire Krieger-Boas, our producer of Talking at Music Education. And we hope you'll join us next time. And thank you for being with us today from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio.
Talking Up Music Education is a podcast created by the NAMM Foundation. To learn more about how you can support music education in your community or how you can be part of the work of the NAMM Foundation, visit our website, www.namfoundation.org, or join us on Facebook at facebook.com/NAMM Foundation. You can also follow Mary on Twitter at Mary LNAMM.